After extreme weather disasters, like the fires burning up entire communities, like flooding decimating farming land and wiping out entire crops for at least a year and sometimes beyond, like tsunamis and hurricanes and tornadoes, the likes of which we have never seen before, headlines start talking about things like the cost of this fire is estimated to be dot, dot, dot. Fill in the blank, hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars. But after the reporting is over, and frequently yet another disaster takes its place in the national news, who stops to ask themselves, is that the true cost? I am telling you, I do not. Or how did those people come up with that number? And more importantly, what is the true cost of these global weather disasters, most of which are a result of climate change? Hey, everybody, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth. And have we got a show for you? Like, I am so excited about this. I'm excited to tell you about our guests and about what we are going to talk about. And if you want to learn more and hear what our guest has to say about the economics of climate change, you really will want to stay right here with me. Because with me is, I like saying this, Skip, John A. Skip Leitner, but we're going to call you Skip, is an international resource economist who leads a team of consultants, the Economic and Human Dimensions Research Associates based in Tucson, Arizona. I'm always proud of that. Skip is the past president of the Association of Environmental Studies and Sciences, AESS, an independent interdisciplinary professional association in higher education. He's also a senior economic research fellow for Russia's largest university system, the Russian Presidential Academy of National Economy and Public Administration. And I have to say, I started typing more, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So we could do a whole show on what else Skip has done. And I decided I don't want spend half the show sharing your accomplishments. People are going to be able to read it on our page when the show comes up. It would be very easy to do, and I say that with a great amount of respect. But you can learn more about his impressive journey on our website. And Skip, finally, you and I have literally spent hours on the phone just talking and me learning and me asking questions about what I call the nexus of climate change and the economy, because I think that's a cool way to put it. But it's a really deep, wide, untalked about topic of the true cost of a disaster. And you have taught me so much. So it's truly one of those, I looked at the pages of notes I took just from our phone conversations, and it's like, well, where do I start? So I think I want to start with, from some indicators, the economy's doing great, right? It's like the numbers are up and the market's up and unemployment is down and kumbaya. It's not the world that I see, quite frankly. So what happens when you take a deeper cut, when you look more deeply like you do by stepping back? And how do jobs and the economy, and more importantly, our economic future look when you're weighing in the reality of climate change?
No, I appreciate the introduction. And yeah, we've had some good conversations. In fact, the questions you've been asking have been helping to stimulate some good thinking. And I recall an economist some years back said, we shape the world by the questions we ask. And I don't think we've necessarily been asking the right questions or the set of questions we need to be thinking through, both in our personal lives, our communities, and certainly within the global economy. But long story short, yes, all the indicators are saying that we've got a full economy. We've got unemployment at a relatively historically low rate, to be sure. But if you step back and look at the larger continuum, say, from post-World War II to today, in the 1960s, maybe productivity economy-wide, per capita GDP, as we sometimes call it, over 2% a year. And there's some surprising twists and turns in that. But today we're getting down to 1.2, 1.4% a year. So we're celebrating a lot of what we're seeing in the moment. But as we really think about what's happening, the economy is slowly eroding out from under us. And a lot of, as you suggest, well, one minor change. Yes, climate change, but environmental burden as well. And by that I mean the huge amount of waste, whether we're talking stuff we pump into the landfill, dump into the landfill, fecal matter, wasted water, all kinds of chemical leakages, things affecting our water quality, our land quality. They create a burden, and sometimes we refer to it as defensive expenditures. That is to say, yeah, GDP is built up and seems to be at a good level, but we have to pull money out of what we normally would spend it on and correct for things like health, things like air quality, or people having some kind of asthma problems, or early mortalities associated with air quality conditions, things like that. That is beginning to lock in. And yes, we're at a good point in one sense, but in a bigger sense, if you travel around the world, there is a definite sign of erosion. We need to really examine that much more closely than we are. I think we may get hit with a very big, unexpected bump in the road.
Skip, why aren't people talking about it? And you're right. When you and I start talking, I have question after question after question. Because from where I sit, with a political bias that I rarely bring up on the show, I think about long-term sustainability and social justice for a truly sustainable planet, right? So that means people. The social justice part is people suffering, people starving, people dying, people not having adequate food and water. So that's one part of the conversation, clearly as someone that I feel is a humanitarian. That's my political party, humanitarian. When people who care a lot about bottom line and ROI and all of those things that are tied to some financial security or strength, you can prove to me, you can prove to everybody listening that that's a very short-term view. Why aren't some of these brainiacs looking at the true cost, the real cost? Because it's taking its toll. We don't even want to go into the arena of what kind of toll does a suicide of a farmer in the Midwest take? And the numbers there are staggering. So that's the social part of it. But in terms of devastation of places that are scarred so much, no economy will ever be able to be back there in 10 or 15 years. Why are more smart people in the news not talking about it? People that I even respect. Like, why isn't Van Jones taking this on, or other economists?
Well, the good news is, I wouldn't call them brainiacs, but smart people, people asking good, earnest questions. They're out there, but they don't know necessarily how to come forward and talk. And one of the good things about your show and the things you and I have talked about are good questions, and good questions with a really good conversation, not just a one-way response to the questions, but good interactive dialogue. We need more of that, much more of that. And I'm thinking, as an example, we've got people up in Alaska right now, some Native American villages that are among the hottest growing villages in the world. They're up at 4 degrees centigrade above average. That's about 7 degrees Fahrenheit. And yet, because they depend on oil, they're torn as a village, a population of 480 people. They get money from oil, and a number of them want to change their ways, but they're still tied to the immediate moment. So part of the difficulty is we're so much in the moment, so much in the maybe family or maybe the block we live on, perhaps the community, and we're so busy. We're being hit by everything from football scores and golf successes to advertising of all kinds and buying the next product, that we don't have the time in our own personal lives to step back and ask the questions. But the interesting part is the data is there. It's just how we choose to bring it forward and talk about it to suggest that, yes, there is that slow erosion. I think Tom Friedman, about a decade ago, quite ironically, said, we're in for a hard decade or a bad century. And that's exactly right. We have about a decade ahead of us to really ask some hard questions. And if we don't begin taking steps forward and looking at the evidence beyond what we're doing, we'll be surprised. And we're going to be facing a very hard, a bad century ahead of us. I'll give you one example. We think about waste, what we fill up in our dumpsters and our landfill. We're about 4 pounds per person per day of what we throw in the garbage. and it's taken out to the landfills. But by the time you add in things like the air pollution, things that are from the burning of fossil fuels and things like that, or greenhouse gases, or fecal matter. We're a population of about 330 million people in the United States, but we have like 85 million cows and 60-some million pigs, and we've got chickens, and we've got other critters. From a human equivalence, we are a population more like 7 billion people, not 330 million people. And we have to contain and manage that. And then when all of a sudden, like in North Carolina, the hurricanes whip up and cause the lagoon farms, as they call them, where they manage the waste, and the winds and the rain and the floods just break that down, and leakages all over the place. So when we add up, we go from 4 pounds per person today to more like 260 pounds per person today, per day. But we don't track it in the same way. Air pollution is something off over there,
right,
and hog manure waste is something way the heck over that way. And yeah, we throw things in the garbage. It's a small amount as we see it. But by the time it all adds up and we think about all the things we have to do to maintain, to really prevent any kind of problems associated with that waste, that's money out of our pockets. We just don't realize it. We don't track it. So somehow we have to open up the dialogue, build up much more trust in each other and a better understanding what's going on, so we can step back and say, that makes sense. We've got to move on this for the well-being of our family, our community, and the larger economy, and we don't do a very good job of that.
No, there is no holistic approach looking at this, and this is kind of like going off-grid for a minute, but I have a very dear friend of mine whose single issue that she focuses on in her circle of influence, which is pretty impressive, is the lasting impact, economic and physical impact of the tsunami in Japan and the nuclear disaster there. And Skip, you know it. We're finding, you can find the nuclear waste from it along the Pacific coast. If you go back there, people are still dying. Kids are getting cancer at 4 years old. Nobody's not even, not only measuring the economic impact of that, they're not looking at the long-term loss, because you and I know, I didn't know, nuclear waste is a forever thing. So it's stored in these containers and they're safe. And don't worry about it, like all the fecal matter you're talking about and the animal, all of that stuff. And then Mother Nature says, ha, 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 ha. You thought it was safe. And it's just, it is not malicious. It's not intentional. It's just real. I mean, it just is, because the ferociousness or the ferocity or whatever you want to use it, the fury of these storms and tsunamis and hurricanes and tornadoes, like we've never seen them. Ever.
Well, it's coming out more and more. Bringing it home personally to me, I have a young nephew who passed away. He was, I think, 43 this past June. And when his dad was stationed at a Marine base way back when he was 1 and 1.5 years old, we think, and the evidence suggests, and more is coming out in this regard, that he was affected by the drinking water, which in turn was contaminated by chemicals from warfare production testing, the bomb runs, the various kinds of things that were being done to really perfect a lot of these things. And I think the evidence suggests that, yep, there is a connection there. But it was 40-some years later. I remember him when he was 12 at my wedding, playing a great basketball game with a bunch of us oldsters, so vital, so full of life, and now he just passed a few months ago because of those connections. And we're seeing more and more of that all around the world, unfortunately. But it's so far removed from us in time and distance, culture, that we don't really take a step back to really appreciate all the dynamics that are going on.
I could not agree with you more. My lunch today, good friend, we were talking about another mutual friend, and I said, you know, how's Becky doing? And she said, you haven't heard? And I was like, oh, no, what? It wasn't about Becky. It was about her 40-year-old son who has stage 4
wow,
cancer. And that, Skip, that just didn't happen when I was 40. If someone my age had cancer, it was like a big red alarm. Oh, my gosh, how can this happen? And now there are children getting cancer and people in their 20s, and, you know, we're not going to go off on autoimmune disease and all that that means, but you're right. When it starts hits home to someone you love, you start thinking about, just what's going on. So you really do have a worldview. You are a global economist. You work with Russia. You work with the World Bank. How does the United States stand up? How do we measure up in terms of, I mean, if there's anything I know after doing this 10 years, there are a lot of incredibly smart, insightful, thoughtful people in this country. And I try to get their voices amplified. I soak it up anytime I can go nationally to hear it. How are we standing up? Not what you see on MSNBC or Fox News or CNN. What's your view from working on the global scene and then coming back here to the United States? How are we doing in addressing any of this?
Yeah, good question. And we do need to step back and ask those questions. But to give you an example, yes, the United States is probably one of the largest economies of the world. We're actually a little bit smaller than the European Union, if we think of them as the United States, but on the same scale. And we like to think of ourselves as number one in so many different ways.
We do.
But if we step back and say, all right, what does number one mean in terms of how we use energy? It turns out that the United States may be about number 30 out of all the countries in the world in terms of how efficiently we use energy. So we let the idea that the United States is a major global power, and in many of our minds, we're number one in the world, and there's some justification, but we don't step back and ask those questions. So I'll give you an example. In the production of electricity alone, just how we generate, how we take coal, natural gas, nuclear, put that into our turbines and generate the electricity, we're maybe at best 33% efficient. That means for every unit of coal that's into a generator and it's distributed to our homes and businesses, we waste about three units. We use three units of coal to generate one unit equivalent of electricity. All of that waste, just the waste, is more than Japan requires for its entire economy. In other words, including transportation, home heating, as well as electricity. What we waste in this country in producing electricity is more than Japan requires to maintain its whole economy. Now, admittedly, Japan is, 120, 125 million people, something like that. We're 330. But that's still a huge problem.
And they're in a really little space.
They are. They are, exactly.
So for this layperson, when you say the efficiency is not there and we waste it, how is it wasted? Explain to us. Is it wasted? We're using energy because we use so much water to produce the energy or the transportation of it. Why is it so inefficient?
Well, let me come at that in two ways. Good question. First is that in the 1960s, when I was in high school, we maybe were in the 20% efficiency, and so we've moved up to maybe 33% in over maybe 50 years now. Not very good. It'd be like having a car that we drove when I was in high school, maybe get 10 or 12 miles per gallon. Maybe it gets 15 or 16 miles per gallon today. Not very good. Fortunately, cars are more efficient than we imagine, but for some reason, electricity has become so conventional in our thinking that we haven't really thought about innovation in the same way. So that's number one. We just haven't really thought of electricity in production and the waste associated. But when you put, say, coal in a combustion turbine to burn that coal to generate steam, a very expensive way to generate steam.
Got it.
A lot of that heat is wasted.
Got it.
A lot of that heat. And then when you get the electricity, you transmit it over to some substations to get that electricity out through the transmission grid
or
the power lines. And then a lot of that's wasted. Fortunately, we're doing a little bit better than a lot of countries in that regard. But in the aggregate, we waste two-thirds of the production and transmission distribution of that electricity. A long way to go. We just haven't been thinking about innovation because it's such an accepted part of our lives that we haven't stepped back to ask better questions how we could do it better.
And the sad thing, and we're not going to go off on this tangent, but I remember it hit me like a ton of bricks when someone on a documentary or a conference I went to, when they were talking about the use of coal, and it was a woman, and she said, easy for you to say, United States, coal got you to where you are in the industrialized nation status, and now help us get where you are. without using coal. And she was, you know, being very smart alecky, saying, yeah, well, you got it. You're there. Now you can look at alternatives. So I think that's a good point. So it begs the question again, are smart climate and environmental strategies in conflict with our social and economic well-being, or is there a way to marry all that together into a holistic picture where everybody wins, including our health and the health of the planet?
No, yeah, you're exactly right. Good question. And I'm thinking, on the one hand, California just celebrated its 1,000,000th solar roof that was powered by PV, photovoltaics, the conversion of light into electricity.
Wow.
And that's huge progress for California. But when we remember we have like 120 or 30 million households in this country, 1 million out of 120 or 30 is small potatoes, so stepping back. But at least there's momentum to share, and we know that the technologies are there if the social will is there to take advantage of them, if we step back and ask those questions. So, yeah, I would say that there are signs of progress and people beginning to wake up, and there are some genuine concern, but there's so much mistrust in the world, whether mistrust of scientists on the one hand, or mistrust from one political party to another, or mistrust even within a community, because you're living in a different part of, say, Tucson than other people might be living in. And somehow we have to bring together that trust in ways that explore these solutions in a larger perspective. But that requires both a dialogue, it requires a sense of urgency, and because the urgency is there, again, getting back to Tom Friedman, it's going to be a hard decade or a bad century. So how we step back and provide that larger perspective is what's before us.
And of course, if you're sitting where I sit and you sit, we have to do it. We have to get there. We have to make sure these marriages happen and that the trust level is built and grows in order for all of us to win. I know something that just gnawed at me like crazy was when I would have people from TEP or from the automotive industry on the show and talk about electric vehicles. And I'm sitting there thinking, great, what are they going to be powered by? Well, one area where I see a little glimmer of hope is when, and this is the truth, when I found out that Shell and Exxon are buying up vacant land all over the country to put solar arrays on, it's like they're coming to the party because they see the future. And if they're buying land to put solar arrays on, they know that's where the money is going to be most efficiently used. It's like, yeah, the big dogs are saying, no, we don't want to open any more coal mines. That's dumb. Without the health and social and all of those implications, they're saying from an economic standpoint, the cost of solar has come down shockingly.
Yeah, no, it has come down. And one of the things I remember in the 70s and 80s, people were saying solar is so expensive, it'll be hurting the economy to invest in that. And yet, precisely because there were pioneers, precisely because there were a few states that took the initiative,
right,
we created the experience, we created the knowledge that in turn contributed to that decline in the solar costs that were now, in many cases, solar is much cheaper, and in many cases, much cheaper than coal, for example, or even natural gas. But how to deploy it and how to create a willingness and a need and a sense of urgency to make that happen is the task before us.
And storage, I mean, it's happening more than I ever thought in my lifetime with this experience for me for 10 years. But based on what some people that I trusted and interviewed said, it's like it might not even happen in my lifetime. And now it's accelerated beyond what my greatest expectations were.
Right.
And Skip, another thing you and I have talked about, we should have had, like I talked to you about, Tuesdays with Maury, we should have had Wednesdays with Skip, because I love our conversations and they help me grow and get a bigger picture and push myself. But a lot of what I try to do is bring it on back, Gina, to there is an imperative that we start getting everyday people engaged, excited, hopeful, knowledgeable about the impact of climate change on their health, on the health of their children, on the health of your nephew, that it's too late. So people say, okay, this is great. You and Skip are having this wonderful conversation about the economic costs of climate change. What can people do? Some ideas, and I know a big one for you personally, is flying. And I was with Diana Liverman from the University of Arizona and a couple of other scientists. It's a big dilemma for them because she needs to go speak at this conference in that got moved to Madrid. Her voice, your voice, it's not the same for everybody if you put it on a Zoom screen. For me, all that's not going to happen. But for you, what do our, we had a million listeners this year. What are some of the things we can do that would really make a difference? And I mean, people laugh at me because I say, don't use a straw. And I say, people, you know what? Straws are a gateway to consciousness. It's not about the straw. It's like if you're thinking about what waste this is, how much it costs to make it, transport it, store it, and ship it, and dispose of it, there's a cost.
Right, right.
What do you say? What should our listeners be saying? What can I do? What the heck can I do?
Well, that's the first question. That's a good question.
Most exactly important right. question.
What can I do? Because for every household, for every family, for every person, it's going to be different. In my case, let's talk about that for a minute. I fly 100,000 miles a year.
Blows me away. And when you told me that, I wanted your frequent flyer miles.
And when I did my footprint, I turned out that I probably use 1/2 to 1/3 of what a normal person uses in my energy in my home. How I eat, I don't drive my car very much. I walk a lot of places, and I don't use much in the way of electricity at all in my home. I use a lot less energy than a typical person in that part of my life. But flying, I go from 1/2 of maybe to 2.5 times. So for me, it makes sense. I'm going to Moscow. I'm going to Paris next month. After that, it will be my last flight because there are alternatives, because we have networks and we have reaching out, just like you're reaching out with podcasts. We have virtual connections we can do through Zoom. One of the best talks I ever gave was in 2010 in Stockholm, Sweden. I had one of the most interactive conversations with people, good dynamic exchange, but I was in Washington, D.C. I was not in Stockholm. That really opened up my thinking. And ironically, it was attorneys who opened up that door for me because they used in 2010 remote access to take affidavits or to pull together initial questioning of people that they might pull into the witness stand. And they did it remotely. And they happened to let me use their technology in 2010. But I've been reluctant to move in that direction for the very reasons you're suggesting. But at this point, I think my choice is to fly no more. That doesn't mean I won't travel by train or see my daughter who now lives and works in Washington, D.C. It just means I won't fly. It means I'm going to have to manage my life differently. It means I have to think about different ways of pulling income in that I might not have imagined. But that's not going to be something everybody can do. But other people can put things like solar on their homes or put in more efficient lighting in their homes or change their pattern of how they shop or doing things more in a multitasking way so you don't have different trips that are separate. You drive the car so much. Instead of doing one trip to accomplish 4 or 5 things, you do 4 or 5 trips. For different people, it will have to be in different ways early on, but we're setting the stage for a much larger reduction so we get to near zero in just 3 decades, basically.
Can you imagine if everyone who attends sporting events in this country figured out a way to either carpool or just watch it on TV or use public transportation? When I go to the U of A game, it drives me crazy because I admit it, I live in the foothills. Do you know how many cars are going down with 2 people in them from Skyline and Sunrise?
Yes.
It's just like, it's crazy. So I have taken the initiative when I'm going with other people that I know are going to the game, we make a loop and we pick each other up and there's 4 to 6 people in the car. Just that alone, it's not going to preserve the planet and save us from disaster. But if hundreds of thousands of people did it, you could start to measure it. That's what I think.
You could. So add to that the idea that rather than going to see the University of Arizona play, what if we had more local teams and we played ourselves? Not everybody can play football, but people can participate in plays or participate in local quizzes or what have you. We socialize more in our neighborhood, in our areas, even as then we use podcasts and other virtual means to connect with people like we're doing with your show here. We're reaching out in some fun ways, but I don't have to travel to wherever. I don't know if you have anybody in Indonesia, but they may be listening, and I don't have to go there to touch base with them. We can do
it. It's true. We have people listen from all over the world to our podcast, and it blows me away when I look and I see where a guest was, and then there's a couple of listeners here and a couple in Brazil and a couple in New Zealand. It's because guests said you just have to go to the World Wide Web. It's called www, and you can hear these podcasts from anywhere. But it does create the need for a shift in mindset, because flying is so convenient, and that's how we got here. Everything's so convenient and time efficient, which sometimes it isn't to use an airport.
Well, we have what I call the difference between the lizard brain and the mammalian brain, because the lizard brain is what keeps us somewhat in health. We don't use too much energy. We don't have to waste too much of our time. We quickly have rules of thumb or patterns of behaving.
Right.
And we don't like to call our mammalian brain, because it requires more energy and more thought, and it's hard to do. So we have conventional wisdom, which is a way of sidestepping hard questions to ask. But now we're at the point where the evidence is emerging that there needs to be some serious questioning in the next 2 or 3 years to avoid that very bad century, unless we face up to some hard realities in the next few years.
And they're really hard. I just read this week, and I think you and I talked about it briefly, but the latest report by maybe Scientific America, I'm not sure, because I become the mush brain. There's the lizard brain, the mammalian brain, and then there's the mush brain, because I read so many things. But it's our report card's going to be really scary in terms of the CO2 emissions for this year. It's very frightening. So for you, who makes your life work about this impact of, you know, economics and climate change, where do we start, Skip? What's a big priority for this country to start looking at? And to me, as a grandma, I'm a grandma, right? With that little 7-month-old, time is speeding up. How do we prioritize as individuals and then as advocates for change? Hurry up.
No, critical perspective. Two things come to mind immediately. Our buildings are probably responsible for over 40% of those carbon emissions.
Love it. The built environment.
Well, the buildings in particular.
Right.
But yes. And transportation. Maybe somewhat less than that, but on the same order. So to the extent we make smart choices about when and where we drive and how we might carpool or share or collaborate more in that way, even as then we begin thinking about new purchase of vehicles, we get the more fuel-efficient ones that we can afford. But then we improve the lighting in our homes and our offices. We improve the way we refrigerate our food, that we don't throw so much food away, that we put in the refrigerator, store there a long time to find out that it's gone bad, so we throw it away. A lot of individual little
food
decisions
waste
can add up to a very big outcome if we choose.
Food waste.
Food waste.
It's like, and to me, the wisdom in your response is, you can't think of it as such a massive problem that you can't make a difference. Start getting down to bite-sized chunks and get it narrower and narrower as to what I can do. And we've made so many changes in our family, like so many. And one of the biggest ones is I cannot do public transportation. It drives me nuts. But what I can do is plan appointments downtown and stack them, so that I'm not driving downtown and coming back and driving downtown and coming back. I can have a noon appointment and a 2 o'clock and a 4 o'clock, so that I have one trip down there. And that's a difference. I didn't mind. I would just, you know, 20 minutes downtown. I'm a Jersey girl.
Yep.
45 minutes on a turnpike was nothing. So I think those mindset shifts will also help. What about our infrastructure and changing our infrastructure? Because when I found out that LA used to have massive public transportation infrastructure, and it got all, closed in, filled in. There were subways, there were trains, and then they had to use those same tracks. Now they're putting it in hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, I'm sure billions. And I read that they're talking about another of what I call a smart extension of the streetcar here, which will help. I loved commuting, Skip. I would drive very close to the train station, get on the train in New Jersey, go to New York. I could get work done. I could sleep because I was young and I might have gotten home at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. So it was a time to nap. It was a time to read and unwind. I commuted. Working at home, I think, is helping. But is public transportation and building that infrastructure critical?
It's absolutely critical. We are, the U.S. is probably a $20 trillion economy. We probably have per capita income on the order of $60,000 per person. A lot more people, a lot less than that. A few people, a lot more than that. But that is the scale of the economy, $20 trillion. We have an infrastructure that's more like $70 trillion. That means $200,000 per person in the way of roads, bridges, parks, water systems, electricity systems. And that all has to be updated in the next 3 decades. So that's a huge problem, infrastructure. We have a lot of individual choices that can buy us time, that we can learn from, that we can be inspired by. But ultimately, we're going to have to come together as a society and say, yes, the private sector, but also the public sector. And I don't think people fully appreciate. I was talking to Larry Morris. He's former mayor of Rockford, Illinois. I gave a talk there. Rockford's a manufacturing town, light manufacturing town, 140,000 people. Larry was a moderate Republican. I gave a talk out there, and he said to me after we went out for a walk, he says, really great, some really great ideas. But then he pointed down to the ground. He said, the sad part of it, Skip, is people don't even know where sidewalks come from. And I was blown away by that because we're so used to sidewalks, we're so used to roads being there, parks being there. People don't understand. It takes investment. It takes public community effort to bring all that to play. Airports,
bridges,
public investment. Yeah, it's just a large
thing. It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
He's advocating, and I like this. I'm probably one of the few guests you've interviewed that, as a man, I actually did take home economics in high school. Larry and I are now beginning to
say, most people listening won't even know what that is. Home ec.
Yeah, home ec, yes. But Larry is saying we need to have a form of community home economics so people better understand what it takes to require and maintain community well-being from the standpoint of public infrastructure, from the standpoint of services offered, whether education or whether shop in high school, talking shop, if you will, and how to learn to do things among ourselves. It's a huge problem, and it's one we got to solve. So a lot of minor, I don't say minor, a lot of important decisions we can do one-on-one for ourselves, even as we're inspired by that and saying that, yes, it takes a public, social, community-wide effort that we all need to be a part of.
This is a really what does Skip think kind of question. I don't know if there's an educated, scientific answer. From where I sit, the kinds of climate change induced, that's my word, the disasters that we're seeing, a wildfire that is so ferocious, it wipes out an entire town in a number of days.
Right.
I'm so obsessed with what the flooding is doing when you took the embargo, you know, the tariff and the rain, the suicide rate of a lot of our farmers is alarming, and the depression rate and all this stuff. When you take a look at some of these things, the devastation is beyond comprehension. Is there any way to hurry up and think about prevention? How, like, I was in the mental health field for 30 years, and it never ceased to amaze me how we would spend 80 to 85% of our money in the state on treatment. And then we would spend a whopping 10 to 15% on prevention. Not rocket science. If you prevent a child from failing in the education system, they succeed. So I, for my 30 years I was in it and at working at the legislature, it's like, we should really be flipping that and putting 80%. And, you know, you have to do one of these things. But is there any way, with all that you know and every place you've been, is there any way we can start preparing for what it is to come? I know places that have horrible tornadoes.
Right.
They're building their houses differently. I interviewed this guy, Mike Reynolds, the guy that started all of the houses in Taos, the earth ships. He was going all over the world building different kinds of houses where they had lots of tornadoes. Is there any prevention strategy for any of these?
Well, there are actually a lot, but they require upfront efforts. I was talking to a colleague who is a the science director for the Department of Energy, he says, you know, people don't realize that the Department of Energy, yes, spent something like $12 billion on various upgrades of technology, but that generated a savings of $230 billion.
That's huge.
It's huge. And people don't, they only see the tax dollars being spent. What they don't see is the huge outcome and the benefits, the savings. When you buy an Energy Star product, Energy Star products, I was with the EPA when we launched that program many years ago. $50 million a year to save billions and billions of people because we have better and more high-performing appliances and equipment that we can save money with on electricity, natural gas, what have you. So the first thing I think people do is, we can prevent by looking to buy Energy Star products, looking and asking construction folks or the people in the offices or manufacturing, what are your more efficient products and what can I buy that is in my price range, and start seeking out that. That would be a huge preventative step that everybody can take. So asking questions like that is important. And that opens up then our thinking to be more aware and to begin engaging others to come together as a community in that regard.
And the way the built environment going forward to me is one of the biggest issues. My friend who owns an architecture firm and is a client, we met about a year ago, and he said, you're missing something really big time, Gina. And I was like, what, Mike? You know, are you going away? And he said, no, the built environment, how we are refurbishing buildings, re-insulating them, how we are building them. And with homes, we build crappy homes as a country, pretty much cheap, not insulated very well. If you buy an Energy Star home, it's a whole different impact than if you buy one that has, they're just, I hate using the word crappy because it's so crass, but they're not good homes. So that going forward, you know, look here, we had an adobe house when we first moved here. We rarely put on the swamp cooler, let alone air conditioning, because guess what? It was a foot thick, the walls, and it didn't get hot because it couldn't get through all of that adobe to make it hot. And that's not realistic for massive growth, let's be honest. We're not going to start building a lot of adobe apartments downtown. But I think building is another place
building
to look.
Building is very good. Folks probably don't know, but my dad was a plumber here in Pima County years ago, master plumber. And he wrote perhaps the first plumbing code for Pima County back in the 70s. And the stories he would tell me is that the corners people are trying to take to cut costs, immediate costs, without any understanding of the longer-term costs, whether you had sewage failures or whether you had leaky pipes, what have you. But in the same way, we're so used to first costs only that I think we need better information, ways to say that when you make a decision to buy a pair of jeans, you're maybe spending several hundred gallons of water to own those pair of jeans. So if you buy too many jeans per year, you're wasting a lot of water. But in the homes as well, what are the costs? And I've actually been thinking about this. A lot of people probably heard of things called blockchain, the electronic ledger idea. And I'm beginning to think, if Pima County were to say to some homeowners or to some people who own private property and encourage them to manage that property in a public-spirited way, if you manage your property differently, you'll save us $10,000 as a county. And we'll use blockchain technology, this electronic ledger, to track that, and we'll give you $6,000 of it back. You'll get a rebate of $6,000 a year because you're managing that. Whether it's less particulate matter, less wasted water, whatever that might look like. And then we'll give $2,000 back to the taxpayer. And then we'll take $2,000 and invest it in more innovation and programs to build out. And then in addition, using things like blockchain as an electronic ledger, enough people start doing that, the revenues of the county will start increasing because we have a healthier economy, and we'll start using that revenue increase as a means to give everybody a little bit of a rebate back in addition. So we can begin putting innovative technologies like that to work if there is a will to make it happen. And that's, I say I'm technologically optimistic, but socially pessimistic.
I'm so glad you said that because I wrote that down when we talked about it. It's like, that is. I mean, it's a great way to put it, and I think it's very honest and
it
real.
It is, and it's a critical perspective that I think we have to be more aware of, and we have to be more trusting of our science and the information that we're finding out. I mean, my gosh, Alaska is heating up 4 degrees centigrade, 7 degrees Fahrenheit. Huge. And the melting that's going on, they have people in the villages whose grave sites of their ancestors are being flooded. And even when they put burials now, they have to drain the burial because of water coming in, because the water is being, the ice is melting faster and they can't control that rain and that sort of thing going on. A lot of stories like that.
The coastal areas, if you don't believe it, go visit Miami.
I've been to Miami, and I can tell you,
octopus coming up through the grates. I mean, you can see it happening. And you know, I love saying that I'm a Jersey girl. And in my lifetime, when I lived there for the first like maybe 23 years, do you know how many times Asbury Park and the boardwalk, that whole area on the Jersey Shore?
I don't even want to know.
Devastated. Like devastated. And guess what?
Yeah.
After the last bad hurricane, I was back there in the last 3 years. Everybody just rebuilt. And if you think, I've seen those waves, if you think you can build a breaker or a wall that is going to sustain the force of Mother Nature when she's at her finest, you can't. So go back farther. It's like, go back, go inland, and who would be building anything in anywhere around New Orleans? I mean, come on, people.
No, you're right.
How many times does it have to hit? And it costs billions and billions of dollars.
That's, again, because we're so much in the moment. As a species, we've been on Earth not very many years, and we're contributing to a faster rate of change because of this enormity of the waste we're creating that's driving climate changes, driving leakages in contaminating our water in ways faster than we've ever imagined. But we don't have the ability to step back and see that larger, which is why we need to bring forward more things like dashboards that explain to people what's happening. Tucson, right now, it seems like cold weather, but we're actually, in the month of December, a couple degrees above average. We love in the weather today.
Everybody's dancing in the streets. It's like, oh, this is why we live here.
Globally, we've had over 400 consecutive months of above average temperatures. That's, my daughter wasn't even born the last time we had a normal, consistent temperature. So the U.S. has been cooler than most, but globally, it's been
devastating.
Massive.
Yeah. Yes, and droughts and starvation.
And we're going to have a lot to pay for that if we don't really pay attention.
We're going to have a lot to pay because it is a global economy.
It
we
is.
Have to remember that. And I want to ask you this before I ask you if there's anything obvious to you that we didn't cover. But when they, the ubiquitous they, are coming out with numbers like this disaster is estimated to be in the range of, let's just say, $450 million for a fire. Do they put into that number, because you're an economist and it's like, I want to know this. Do they put into those numbers some people that will never be able to own a home again, that have lost their homes, lost their land, may be unemployable, may have to go on unemployment, may have to retire early? I mean, you and I know that in Houston, there are people living in the homes that were destroyed that are not safe, that are unsanitary, that are disease-ridden, because guess what? They don't have a second home, they don't have a job, they don't have savings. They're living in heinous conditions. Does that get measured in that, you know, $443 million for this one thing?
A really good point. And the answer, no surprise, no. When we do things like what a hurricane may cost or what Houston is now paying, it's essentially reconstruction. I remember being in 1989 working with the Virgin Islands, the U.S. Virgin Islands, after Hurricane Hugo hit. And I was working with what we call FEMA, Federal Energy Emergency Management Administration. And we noticed that the builders, re-roofing some of the buildings, were putting roofs on the same way as they did before. And we said, you know, if you start driving your nails in at a 45-degree angle instead of a 90-degree angle, it'll create more resistance to wind. And he says, well, we were told to build it like we found it, and no new insights. So two things. We haven't learned how to manage. We're rebuilding the same way we used to. And we haven't really had the impact of, exactly as you're suggesting, people who are losing homes, people who have higher health care costs that are paying a bigger part of their income, if the income is there, to offset those costs. So, no, the $443 billion is only, I would say, maybe half of what the actual cost is. But how can you measure cost in the sense of human well-being, social well-being.
I know. It's infinity. That's the word I use. I remember we were watching something, my husband and I, and it was the flooding in Florida, and the mayor, somebody was saying, get out, get out, get out, get out, get out. It's going to be bad. There's no doubt about it. And there were people staying. And I said to my husband, I said, how could they be so stupid? There's all the warnings. And he looked at me like I was nuts. And he said, are you really asking that question? How about maybe they have nowhere to go? How about maybe they don't have a car?
That's right.
How about they don't have a relative in New Jersey or upstate or inland? Maybe they're not leaving because they don't have a choice. And I said to him, shame on me. I will always have a choice.
Well, that's an important issue. In fact, we're seeing studies now suggesting that climate change may be a huge driver of immigration, on the order of over hundreds of millions of people having to relocate in the next 3 decades or so, simply because they can't afford to live there, or they're driven out for various reasons.
Or there's no food, or there's no water.
And water is everywhere.
Wait till it starts hitting here.
That's right.
And see how everybody likes it.
And I'll tell you, 2 years ago, I have a brother that lives in Santa Rosa, California. Went through the fires and the Tubbs fires. Fortunately, his home was okay. He just suffered pollution, but he had friends that lost their homes. The same year, my daughter was finishing up her PhD in Florida and went through Hurricane Irma. Same year, 2 different disasters, but it was amazing that it hit so many different ways that we're not prepared for.
That touched your own life. I'm on the phone this winter calling Bonnie from our team who lives in Michigan and Dave from our team who lives in Massachusetts saying, do you have a generator? Blah, blah, blah. The snow they're getting and the freezing temperatures, people will die. So I hope this is the first of many conversations. It's like it really, we covered a lot.
Created a lot of ideas in my mind.
A lot. And same here. And like I do take notes and I do listen. So if you don't have anything else to say, you know I love having the last word.
Well, one thought is, as an economist, I'm stepping back to imagine it's not just growth and income that we're interested in. Looking back to the 70s, if we differentiate between a progressive income, meaning income you spend to bring about a joy in your family or happiness or be able to gift giving or celebrate with family, versus what we call defensive expenditures. In other words, more and more of our income that we get is going to offset health costs, are more and more to protect oil supplies around the world because we think we need that oil. Defensive expenditures come in so many different ways that if we back out defensive expenditures, we're going to find that our per capita income is basically flat in terms of the things that we want to really spend money on that bring joy and happiness to our community or our family. So we need to begin looking more and more, not just at income, but how that money is spent and the amount of defensive expenditures that are taking out of our budget increasingly.
So what a perfect segue. And we did not set this up because one of the things that came to mind as I was reflecting on what we might talk about, what you might share is my favorite tagline that we have used when we launched the podcast and opened the studio is, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And let that sink in because you have given me and now thousands of people who listen to this something to think about, lots to think about in good ways. I don't think this was a depressing show. I think it was a wonderful show to give us new insights and a new slant and a new perspective on the true costs of climate change and, more importantly, what we can do about it. So to me, it's like, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I hope that people share my view about we have a lot to think about because I personally believe we are really fighting the biggest battle of our lifetime and the stakes are really high.
And you've given me a lot to think about. Exactly right.
That makes me feel really good. Like I'm going to be bragging about that. I gave Skip Leitner some things to think about. So for everybody out there, I always end the show the same way. I thank my guests and Skip. It's been delightful for me. Like, I have no idea how much time we were even on this because I wasn't looking at the clock. I felt complete. And then to all our listeners, I pretty much say thank you because without you, there would be no me. There would be no need. So I'm so appreciative of our listeners. And just go out there, everybody, and make it a great, green, intentionally lived day. If we start living with intention, just that, it'll change the landscape. So, Skip, thanks for showing up in my world.
Well, thank you, and keep those questions coming.
I will.